With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the Posecast, featuring three-time champion, one of the original 3&D guys, James Posey. I'll be your host, Jameson Welsh. And today, we have a very, very special guest joining us today. One of the most highly decorated players ever, and the current coach of the University of Virginia women's basketball team, Mrs. Tina Thompson. Tina, how's your morning going thus far?
It's going pretty good. A little better now that I get to see my guy, Jay.
What up, T? How you doing? You all right?
I'm good. Things are well. Things are good.
Thanks for taking the time out your busy schedule with everything that's going on. We appreciate it.
Yeah, this is an easy call for me.
Listen, jumping straight into it, how many championships you got?
Just four.
Oh,
I don't think so.
Just four? You sure?
Just four.
That's all you claim?
If you're counting like Olympic championships and things like that. WNBA championships, I have just four. And then I have championships in like other countries and stuff, but in America.
But what? You're not going to count those, T? Come on. You the goat, baby. It's okay. You can brag. It's all good.
Well, I don't know. Like, I have, okay. Let me think. All right. So I have 2 EuroLeague championships, 2 Russian League championships, a Romanian championship. I only played in a couple countries. I have 2 Olympic gold medals and some world championships and 4 WNBA championships.
Hey, it's coming from you. So you forgot about those. You got to claim them all, TNT. That's why you the GOAT, baby. That's why you the GOAT.
You know, it's a lot to process. And, you know, I'm not an accolades person. So, you know, it's not something that I think about often.
Well, people ain't forgetting about that. They know. If they know you, they know. For real, for real. How did you end up at USC?
Well, I'm originally from Los Angeles, California. Really kind of crazy, just the whole thing of college scholarships and, you know, going to college and all that kind of stuff was very new to me. So, you know, I played basketball at my rec center. It's where kind of like my love grew. And for the most part, I played with boys. So I didn't really play like on girls teams or anything like that. Not until I actually got to junior high school and they didn't allow me to play like with the boys. So I did have a little team for about a year or so in my elementary school. But, you know, it wasn't like my team. You know, my team, in my opinion at that time, was my like rec league team. So when I got to junior high school, the coach made a team, and he was like my like math teacher, made a team so that I could actually play because they wouldn't let me play on the boys team. So when I got to high school, it was like I had to now like play with girls, and I'm still playing because I loved it. I'm still going home like every day, every summer, like playing at my park. So when I got to high school, like, you officially have to play with girls. Like, there's no more playing with boys. And I'm just playing because I loved it. I didn't even know that I could get a college scholarship. So after my first year in high school, my coach brought me like these boxes and they had all these letters in there. So my initial thought was that it was fan mail. I didn't know that it was like actual recruiting letters. So then he explained it to me, like what it was. And I was like, what? So, you know, he took me home because I had these boxes because I had to commute, like getting home. So I was taking the bus. And I told my mom, like, Mom, like, Coach Scott just told me that this box, like, these boxes are people who want me to, like, go to their school and they're going to pay for it. So she's like, what? You know, we need to go through them. So I go through all of them because my dream school at the time was Harvard University. I wanted to be a judge. So I wanted to go to Harvard to have a great undergraduate and then to Harvard Law. So my first kind of look through is that I'm going through both boxes, every single one, one by one, looking for a letter from Harvard. There was not a letter from Harvard. So disappointment at first, but then a guy at my park, I was just kind of telling him the whole story. He tells me that, well, Harvard doesn't really give like scholarships, you know, you can get grants and stuff like that. So that's the reason why you probably don't have a letter. So then I was like, okay, if not Harvard, because these people are paying for free. Let me find someone else. So my then choice was Stanford. So I didn't tell anyone other than my immediate family that Stanford was my choice. Once you start going through the recruiting process and, you know, I started getting more notoriety, I started getting more attention. I met the coaches at USC, for me, comparable, you know, educations with Stanford and USC. And they were kind of the places to be academically. I formed a relationship with the coaches, you know, what you do in the recruiting process. And Mary Ann Stanley, who was the head coach at the time, she just won me over. And, you know, just her honesty and just her realness. And she didn't promise me anything. So although I did apply for Stanford and I did get in, so I don't know if you guys know, you have to get in first before they offer you. Like, they play no games. it was the relationship and dynamic, like, just with the staff that made it easier. And then it was 25 minutes from where I grew up.
Now, how was it following Lisa Leslie at Morningside? Because she broke the scoring record in a game there, amongst all the other records there. How was it following her at Morningside and then also at USC?
So naively enough, I didn't know who Lisa was before I went to Morningside High School. So being in Los Angeles, because Morningside High School is in the Inglewood School District, they're two totally different kind of worlds in a sense for sports. My junior high school went to the 9th grade. So I didn't actually go to high school until the 10th grade. So had I gone in the 9th grade, then I would have actually played with Lisa. But again, like, I was in the world of playing basketball with boys, so I didn't really know a lot of, like, girls basketball players, you know, at the time. So it wasn't until I got to USC, to Morningside, did I become more familiar with Lisa. Again, just kind of not knowing. I knew that that school had won a lot of championships and they had had a lot of good players. Like, as I started to get more attention, then, you know, people started talking about Lisa more and I became more familiar. And then she actually had come back to, like, visit the school. So I met her personally. So for me, it wasn't kind of like following, just because I didn't know, like, enough information. But, like, at the same time, you know, I was who I was. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, a matter of just kind of like following anyone. But the idea of actually going to USC and being able to play with her, like, that was a conversation.
Now, question here. USC has a very extensive background when it comes to great women's teams. However, they rarely get mentioned when they talk about the all-time teams. We hear about UConn all the time. We hear about Tennessee, Notre Dame. But USC's Mount Rushmore of women basketball can play with anyone, and you can make argument is the best out of any of the schools out there. Why don't y'all get mentioned with the other schools?
I don't know. But again, it's not my concern because it's just not like how my thought process works. I deal in facts, and our Mount Rushmore is all Hall of Famers. So if they want to have that conversation, so not just Women's Basketball Hall of Famers, but Naismith Basketball Hall of Famers that have got in as basketball players and not anything else. I do think that the timing, especially in those times when Cynthia Cooper and Shawn Miller were at USC, although they got a lot of attention because of the teams that they were at that time, women's basketball wasn't getting the attention that it probably deserved at that time. It just wasn't necessarily the thing to do or to be on television. There are so many teams that during that time were incredible. You think about the University of Texas teams, you think about the Old Dominion teams and Immaculata, like there's so many amazing teams that it was just kind of like a sign of the times. So now college women's basketball is something that people want to see. You know, they watch it and they have a following in a way that it demands, you know, TV attention. So people are familiar with and they talk about what they know. So I think that it might be a little bit of just ignorance and just kind of not knowing.
They just recently retired your jersey. What took them so long? I mean, I don't know the process because I don't have nothing retired, but they just did. What took them so long, T?
I really am not sure. I know that it should have happened a little earlier than it did, but it was just an issue of like scheduling and things like that. Me being away when I was playing overseas, and not being here like during the winter time when college basketball is actually happening. I know that that was kind of in the way post, I guess, retirement or when I was no longer going overseas. I really don't have any idea. So I just think a lot of people kind of started changing how they went about things once I was nominated for induction into the Naismith Hall of Fame, because I had not even been inducted or invited to the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame. So I was nominated for the Naismith before I was nominated for the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame.
They was hating that hard, T?
I don't know. You know, to me, the most important things is the respect of your peers. And reality is I am your favorite basketball's player's favorite basketball player. Mm-hmm. So sure. That's enough.
You know, you my favorite. You the GOAT, baby. I tell you, I say it all the time. You the GOAT.
Jay has been my guy for whatever. He was actually shooting with me in the gym. Real talk.
Yeah, I was.
Shoot with the gym.
Yeah. So listen, you do work USC, and now you the number one pick to the Houston Comets. What was that feeling like? And did you think like, man, this professional, you know, gig for me, basketball, what you love to do, like, was it a dream come true?
I cried. I know it's embarrassing to say today, but I cried because I had to leave California. Like, everyone who knows me well knows that I am a California girl
through and through.
Yep. So the idea of having to leave my family, because I spent my whole collegiate career there, and just the relationships that I had just with my community and my friends and everything, like it was going to be tough. Like in my mind, I never imagined leaving California. So the Los Angeles Sparks had the number 3 pick. You know, they invited me over. We went to some Lakers games. I had great seats. And they were like, if you are available, you know, we're going to pick you at number 3 or 4. But I believe it was 3. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll be there for number 3. Like, let's make it happen, you know. And I get the call from the Houston Comets. And Van Chancellor is telling me that he wants to pick me at number 1. And I'm kind of like quiet, like in my mind, why do you want to pick me at number 1? But again, it was the pick me anywhere. Like I know what I'm going to do. I wasn't enamored necessarily with number 1. Again, that's youth, because now I know that it was such a huge thing. But my immediate response was like, I was a little devastated. Because I wanted to stay. And when I got to to Houston, I probably gained about 15 pounds because I know now that I might have been depressed because I had Bluebell ice cream every single day and cried every time I talked to my family. And I'm not a crier. So it worked out for the best, but I was not as happy as one would probably assume I should be.
So you go to you're the number one pick, you get to the comments. Now, I'm just, interested to see how this happened between y'all getting Cynthia Coop, and then also you also get, Cheryl Swoops. How did that sort of happen? You know what I'm saying? Like, they talk about the big three now here in the men's league. Y'all actually was the big three then, you know what I'm saying? So how did that sort of come about?
Well, it's kind of one of those things. Well, it came about because of one person, one man, Carol Dawson. So Carol Dawson at the time was the president or general manager of the Houston Rockets. So initially with the WNBA, I'm not sure everyone knows, but we were like sister teams of NBA teams. So the NBA teams worked with, the staff that they hired for the WNBA, but a lot of them had dual roles. So Carol Dawson asked for tape or video footage of everyone that was eligible to be in the draft. He went through game film of all of these players. And from that film, he decided who he wanted to pick. So Cheryl Swoops, Cynthia Cooper, myself, Jeanette Arcane, Tammy Jackson, everyone that was selected was based on the film that he watched. The only player that was selected that was kind of like a wild card was our point guard, Kim Perrott. And she was selected from a group of almost a few hundred women that came to a local trials in Houston. Everyone else, Amaya Valdemoro, Polina, like they all were selected from game film that Carol Dawson watched. So his basketball mind, which I think is one of the most incredible I've ever experienced, picked an entire team by watching film because he was familiar with none of us.
Wow.
Pretty incredible story, right?
Yeah, it is.
Now, Tina, what were some of the biggest adjustments going from college to now the WNBA where you're playing against professional women now?
I felt like I played the Pac-12 of 10 at the time. It's now in the Pac-12 was really competitive. So, I thought that, I had like enough experience coming into the WNBA. I believe it was IQ. It was the first time I had ever played with a group that had high IQs, understood the game. So the adjustment for me was rather easy. I would say that the physicality was kind of like a step up, for playing in college. I was considered a very physical player. But then going to the WNBA, I was playing against players that could match my physicality. As far as just being able to play and like fit in, I don't believe that was kind of ever a problem. I mean, I, just kind of worked, and I was also a student. So, I figured out or kind of found ways to make like the adjustments necessary in order to be able to be efficient.
Now, how did y'all mesh so well? Because usually when talent like that comes together, there's always some growing pains. There's always some issues. But like Pose mentioned, you guys had a big three and hit it off immediately, end up winning four straight championships. How did y'all mesh so well and become so successful?
I think that the biggest factor was selfishness. Like, we were selfish in the sense that we wanted to win. So winning came first at all cost. We were not very good losers. We were without like the growing pains and the drama. Like, it was big time drama. But once we stepped in between those lines, like the want to win was the most important thing. And it was just the thought process and the idea of everyone on our team. So it was so much so that there an argument could happen in the locker room while we're walking out before we stepped into like courtside in the arena. And as soon as we got into warmups, just like that, the change, the click, because the most important thing was winning. So it was for sure probably one of my most dramatic basketball playing experiences, but it was the most competitive in the sense that nothing was more important than winning.
So you win your first championship. Now you think, you know, everybody, you know, goal and dream is to win, you know, a championship. Did you really think that you could win, like, not only one, but, like, two? But y'all get a four-peat. So 4 years in a row, y'all basically held the league down, ran the league, and everybody else, like, was couldn't compete. Did you think that was possible just, you know, from based on your team?
Well, after we won the first one, ironically enough, like I have to keep saying that, or funny enough, we weren't even picked to make the playoffs, our team. We weren't picked to make the playoffs. So, wow. And I think it was partly because Sho Swoops had announced that she was pregnant and that she wasn't going to be playing. And she joined the team much later in the season, so we were playing without her. So we knew that we were still really good. Everyone else didn't know that. So going into the season, we still were like, you know, we have a chance, you know, we're going to be a problem for some people. So if LA and if New York, these guys are like the picks, like they're going to kind of have to go through us. And we had Cynthia Cooper. Like Cynthia was an absolute beast, like her just mentality, her level of toughness, and her competitive nature. So we win the first one with Cheryl like being a shell of herself. We're like, man, we don't ever have to lose. Like as long as we are together, we will win. And from that moment on, that was the attitude that every single day we're in practice, it needs to be the most competitive experience that we had. We played against men. JP was a part of that group of guys. So we played against NBA players, former NBA players, coaches in the NBA who had very good, you know, collegiate careers or at some point played professionally. Like the competition that we played against was serious. It was physical and it was competitive. So more times than not, going into WNBA games, the practice that we had the day before was tougher than the actual game that we played in. So I actually blame Cynthia Cooper as to why we only won four championships, because she decided to retire and she just broke up the band.
Wow. So speaking of Cynthia, like, she was really, you talk, when you bring her name up, it's like she was the female Jordan, you know what I'm saying? And that's how people saw her. So before then, did you learn anything or know anything about, you know, her? And how did you, like your game, who did your game sort of resemble? Or it was just, I'm Tina and this is my style of play, period?
No. So I do believe that you could pick whatever, you know, great player you want to pick and compare Cynthia Cooper to her. She can be Magic. She could be Larry. She could be whomever, you know. She was that type of, like, you know, superstar player that she could take over a game. And she just kind of had that competitive nature that just wasn't comparable to most. What I learned from Cynthia was professionalism. So when I first came to the Comets and we were having our first official practice, I showed up early just to kind of get some extra work in. So it was a little over an hour before we actually started practice. I was going to come in and work out and just get some shots up. When I actually came to the gym, Cynthia was finishing her workout and she was running suicides by herself. So she was completely drenched because she had been on the Stairmaster and the EFX. She had done weights, and then she did a basketball workout. And then at the end of that workout, she was doing sprints by herself before practice. So like, what? Like, what's going on here? She had to go and shower and get another set of practice gear so that she could be available for practice. And for me, seeing that on the first day, I was like, oh, I need to step my game up. Like, I need to get on the Cynthia Cooper level. So from that point on, she was the standard of how I would handle myself professionally, how I would work on my game, how I would show up every single day. And that was almost immediate. From a basketball standpoint and just where I got my game, like, I stole from everyone that I could. When I saw a move or something that could work, I took it. The kind of meat of my game are very much like moves that I had stolen from James Worthy, Kiki Vandeweghe, and Dream. Mm-hmm. My Kiki, JP gave me that. Is from his time in Denver. He was like, T, like, you need to add this to your set. You need to add this to your combination. And I was like, okay. So we literally spent, I don't know, maybe like 20 minutes. And it was like a day before the game. So we worked on it. And the next day in that game, I used it. So after the game, because we were like friends, I was like, wait, did you see that Kiki though? I used that Kiki. And he was like, no, I saw it, TDC. I saw it. So it was just me kind of watching the game. I was a student. Like, I love the game of basketball. So I watched it all the time. Carol Dawson, who taught Dream, you know, his combination of moves, he spent about 30 minutes with me over 3 different days, like, showing me, you know, the combination of those moves. So, you know, the fall away, the Dream shake, you know, the face up, you know, the ball fake into the hook shot, like, all of that stuff. So I just kind of incorporated it into my game and made it my own. Just from an outside shooting perspective, I got that simply by playing with boys. Like, even though I was really tall, I was really skinny and not very strong. So I had to play on the outside because I couldn't, you know, compete with them physically. So that's how I learned how to shoot. And later, you know, as I got older and a little taller, I had to play inside. So that's when I learned how to be a post player.
Oh, Tina, quick question here. I know you're from the West Coast. What other hotbeds in the country do the most talented female ballers come from? Because a lot of people say Chicago or DC or wherever it may be. But where, you know, I know Southern California has a very long lineage of players. What are some of the other hotbeds in the country?
A lot of players come from Texas. A good number of players come from Texas. A lot of players come from, like, the DMV area. That DC, Maryland, Virginia area, they have a lot of talented players. Now, of course, there's like players that come from all over the country. But if you kind of look like at the masses, you know, California, Texas, and the DC area, and then there are a lot of just kind of players that come from these small towns around the Mason-Dixon line and, that were, you know, they just come from these small towns. They go to schools in the South, don't really leave that area, but they have like big game. And I wouldn't necessarily say like there is one place, but if I would have to choose like 3 kind of big areas, I would say those. In New York, I do believe that like New York and that New Jersey area too has a lot of kids. Or just a lot of players come from there.
You talked about your work ethic and your grind in the gym. And the crazy thing about it, how our friendship, you know, I say started, you was getting shots up one night by yourself in the gym. And I'm coming in about to get some shots up myself, but I'm sitting on the side just waiting. And you just knocking down jump shots, going to get your own rebound. And I was like, excuse me. You want me to rebound for you? And you like, nah, I mean, I got it. And I'm like, I mean, I'll rebound for you. And like, I was just pretty much getting to Houston and everything. And I would come to your games, but I was nervous. I was like, she about her business. Like, it's Tina Thompson. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know, but I asked. And then finally you was like, okay. So I rebounded, you know, so I rebounded for you. And then you got done with your workout. Small conversation, not much. So I'm like, shit, I just rebounded for Tina. You know what I'm saying? I'm geeked. I'm excited. And then you just go about your business. And then I would continue to come over to West Side. And then like our conversation just, you know, it got, you know, bigger and bigger. And the next thing you know, I got season tickets. I'm from row C at the comments. Like, yo, I got to see this. You know what I'm saying? Y'all winning and everything. So I was like, man, I'm sitting here watching Tina Thompson play. And I mean, with Cheryl and Cynthia, but I'm like, man, like this T right here, like I actually have a connection with you. And like I said, from there, you know what I'm saying? It, things grew. So I appreciate that. Let me rebound for you.
The funny thing about that is because I was, you know, so much of it like was just how I was raised and all that kind of stuff. So like coming to Houston for me was crazy. My idea of Houston was like really country. Like I was going to get there. People were going to be wearing cowboy boots and Wranglers and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Because the last time I had been to Texas, like for me coming from LA, I was like, oh, this is really country. But that had been, you know, quite a while before then. And I wasn't an adult. So coming to Houston, because when we were there, it was hot. So many professional athletes, NBA players, football players lived in Texas, even though they were from different states, you know, and just all over the country. So being in Houston, it was such a great time. The Rockets were really good then, and then the Comets were winning, but there was just such a huge kind of basketball community and camaraderie. But with that, there was a lot. Like, I wasn't kind of like a partier. Like, I didn't go out. I didn't anything. I didn't mix, like, with a lot of players. Like, I would say, hello, how you're doing? And then I would, like, move on. So when you were like, you want me to rebound for you? I was kind of like, no, like, I don't want those kind of problems. So I was just like, I don't want to get mixed up in anything. And that was just kind of, and again, like, just being, like, really naive, you know, me thinking, like, NBA players are the most. Like, I hear about all the stories because I had friends and all that kind of stuff. So literally, over time, it was just a matter of us kind of getting to know each other and then realizing, like, you were the best guy ever. Like, we, like, literally create this lifetime friendship, and then we're in the gym just kind of, like, growing our games together or whatever. Like, it was, you know, perfect because I was there by myself. I didn't have, you know, a lot of friends, and then we began having friends like in common because we were a part of, you know, the same group, and like you were a worker. So, you know, it just kind of matched my personality as well. And, you know, we talked hoops and all that kind of stuff. And we just ended up having a good time. I remember there was a time where, like, I didn't even go out unless you were, like, going out too. I would be like, hey, Jay, are you going to go and, like, hang out? Because if you're not going, then I'm not going to come situation. Just because, like, for me, you know, it was a comfort. And the same thing with, like, Steve Francis and Contino and those guys. But, you know, I'm like, if I go out and I'm in this environment, then I need to kind of have like my boys there. So, you know, for me, it was like a huge part, you know, of my growth and just allowing me to be a lot more social and things like that, because I was very, you know, initially to myself.
And you talk about, you know, helping my game, you know, with my 3-point shooting and also getting the ball off quicker because, you know, I was a seeing guy. And I used to look, I say, T, how you shooting this ball? Like, you just catch and shoot. No seams, whatever. You just catch and shoot. And you walked me through that whole process and helped me. And I'm like, man, just be able to catch the ball, seams or no seams, and shoot. And I started making a few. I said, okay. Let me see if I can make a few more.
No, you're right. Well, it's part of it was, is that so for a very, just most of my like basketball career, except when I played with boys, was the only time I didn't receive like double or triple teams. So like I literally, there wasn't a game where I wasn't getting trapped or triple teamed or something like that. So I had to start like making adjustments and growing my game, you know, so the setting it and all that kind of stuff and the feel or whatever. My brother actually said to me, like, you're going to have to just shoot it from where you catch it, man. Because he was just that, you know, like, kind of guy. Like, just shoot it from where you catch it. Like, you're not going to get, you know, whatever. Like, you need to figure out how to be able to shoot and make everything. And I was just like, you know, rolling my eyes, but okay. But it did kind of like make sense. So then I actually just started practicing that. So the only time I would actually kind of set the ball was when I shot free throws. Other than that, it was catching from when I, wherever, you know, shooting for wherever I caught it. So if it was a bad pass, as long as I could get it to my pocket, then that's where I could like shoot it from. So there was no adjustments after that because I needed that extra, that time to be able to like get it off. Like I needed to be able to shave off time actually, to actually get shots off because someone was always there.
Now, Tina, you end up going overseas for a while. What came into that decision? Was it just time for you to make that decision? Was there a better offer over there? Why overseas?
Money. Only reason. I am an absolute American. I do not like traveling outside of America. I don't like, I love foreign food, but I love it in America. I appreciate the culture of other countries. Every time I've ever been, I made it a point to kind of learn something or to experience something in whatever country I was in that was uniquely to that place. But I'm not a big traveler and I just love being at home. So it was for sure financial security. And I had turned down opportunities for a really, really long time. And I only decided to do so because of financial security and just, you know, preparing for the future. I didn't play a lot of times. It's just that the deals that I actually took, they were absolutely worth it. So I played in Russia. I played in Korea. I played in Italy. And I played in Romania.
Now, what were some of the challenges of playing overseas? Because we always hear about everyone's struggle stories or everyone's horror stories over there. What were some of the challenges that you had to go through while playing overseas?
Well, I think it's just the adjustment of just like the culture and the unfamiliarity of that. Like in Italy, I was in a very small town, like in the north, like in the mountains, Rovereto, and no one spoke English like in the town that I was in. It was very Italian. So I had a translator and there were a couple of my teammates that spoke English. My coach did not even speak English. So just not having someone to be able to communicate with, but also you had to navigate through things, not being able to speak the language. Like in Italy, everything is, you know, people go to the grocery store every single day. So I would go to the market and they would look at me like, why is she buying all that stuff? Because for me, and you know, in America, like you get snacks like for the week or, you know, milk and juices and stuff like that. So they actually had to acquire me a bigger refrigerator because even in the homes, the refrigerators are really small because they don't need to have anything for storage because everything is fresh. But we would have the opportunity to go to the base. Taj Williams Franklin was a WNBA player. Her and her husband were stationed in the base, like not far from, or maybe a couple hours from where my town was. So I would go to the base and be able to get American food, like on a pass through her. So like I needed a bigger refrigerator so that, you know, I could store all of kind of like the familiar things, you know, from America. So that was for sure an adjustment, the language and just not having the versatility of being at home. Like when you're in Italy, you eat Italian food every single day. There is not a place that you can go and get guacamole. There's not a place that you can go and get, you know, like fried fish or soul food or, you know, like Chinese takeout. There isn't any of that. It is Italian food every single day. And then you go to a place like Russia. Not very many people speak the language. A lot of women do because, you know, they're trying to find American husbands. Right. No kidding. Right. But they're also not sports people. So the, you know, the relation and the thought process and all that kind of stuff is not very familiar. Russia is very opposite of America, like the weather, kind of the harshness, like of the living, and just, I mean, the language, the alphabet. They don't even use, you know, the same alphabet that most languages use. So that was tough. And the winters. And then you go to a place like Korea that has everything that is America. So for a social kind of from perspective, it's great. But at the same time, again, the language barrier, not being able to read the signs because, again, they use a different structure in language. So just social interaction was probably the most difficult thing.
Now, what about basketball-wise? Because going from the WNBA to overseas, what was the different types? Was there a difference or was it pretty similar? What were the challenges there?
So in Russia, like, my team was stacked. I played on a team with Diana Taurasi, Lauren Jackson, Sue Bird, Tisha Pinichero. So, I mean, we were a really, really good team. But Russia was different as far as their rules and the allowance of foreign players. When I played, so although I was, you know, the leading scorer or the leader on that team, the type of help that I had was different, but also the level of competition in the Russian league and Euro league was not comparable to any other leagues like in the world. When I played in Italy or, you know, a place like Romania, it was like, give her the ball, let her score all the points. Whatever it is that she says is going to work, that's what we're going to do. So total difference. And then playing in Korea, they are in incredible shape. They practice three, sometimes four a day. Four times a day because basketball is what they do. So for the foreign players, we would have two practices a day, one in the morning and one in the evening. And I played the entire game. Like I never, you know, came out of the game. So my coach was like, don't foul. Like if you feel like you're gonna foul, just let them go because I can't afford to take you out of the game. And we ran constantly. So playing in Korea, I was in the best shape of, you know, my life just because of how, you know, they worked and just the efficiency of it. But again, I'm the tallest player other than like the KBL players in the entire country, me and, you know, my American counterparts. But the style of play, none of them, you know, the same. I would say playing in Russia was the most like, I guess, like playing in America.
So you come back, like I said, you had your four-peat, you win it overseas. Now you're coming back and you have an opportunity to play for your home team. And then you actually ended your career playing in Seattle. So how was that? And were you thinking about, hey, I'm trying to get a fifth ring? Because those things were still pretty good, but I'm just saying that hunger was still there and the opportunity to get a fifth to really separate yourself?
No. Well, so devastation and actually the Comets folding and not being able to end my career there. So that was just really, really tough to move forward from. The reason why I chose Los Angeles was there was familiarity, but my son Dylan was starting school. And also my grandmother was getting older. So my grandmother enjoyed coming, you know, to the games and being in that environment. For the last maybe 2 or 3 years in Houston, she did not feel comfortable traveling and spending time with us in Houston just because, you know, she was just a lot like older. So me going to LA those decisions weighed like heavily on me kind of making that decision. My grandmother being able to see me play and also my son Dylan being able to start like his formative years in school in Los Angeles. I wanted him to be in a very diverse environment, education-wise, just so that he would be familiar about with being around, you know, other people. Like Jay, as you know, being in Texas and the side of Texas that we live in, you know, when there's not a high level of diversity for them. So for Dylan, it was something that I absolutely wanted to do. And going to Seattle, the reason why I chose to go there, because I thought that I would end my career in LA, is that on my team in LA, there was just a lot of drama. And as you know, like, I am not like a dramatic person like that. Like, I don't do really good with like chick stuff. So I needed to be in an environment where like the last, you know, couple years of my career were going to be, you know, filled with hard work, being competitive, having the opportunity to win, but, you know, they be enjoyable. So that's why I actually chose to go to Seattle. And I can say today that even though I won championships in Houston and I love the women that I played with, my best professional basketball experience was with that team in Seattle.
With the landscape of the WNBA and your team and your run with the Comets, do you think it would ever be another team like that? And if so, what would it take for that to happen?
I would say absolutely not. It's just the difficulty of it and the mentality that you have to have and the level of work that you have to be on that level consistently. I just have not met very many people that are willing to do that. I also believe that the mindset of players has changed in the sense that who we were as young people, as basketball players, it's very different today. And not that it's anything against these guys, but opportunity, what's available to them has changed. So their mindsets are different. Like, my parents would have laughed at me if I said I needed a trainer. Like, they were going to pay someone to, like, teach me how to play basketball so that I could have, like, this certain experience that I would have to say that I need to pay to go to this place. And they were like, Robertson Recreation Center is a 15-minute walk. Like, right. You better get out there. Right. Call your buddies, meet on the way, and get to the park. So the experiences that they have are very different than the experiences that we had. No one was videotaping me working out so it could be, you know, a snippet on, you know, some mixtape so that I can post on like my Instagram. The thought process is extremely different. So the dedication, although these guys are really talented, the mentality is so different. Girls that I played against were not my friends. Don't come and dap me up. We're not going to hug before the game. Like, don't say anything to me during the game. Like, I'm not, like, trying to hear it. No, we're not going to dinner, like, afterwards. Like, I'm going to dinner with my teammates. And if I did go to dinner with you, it's probably because you were my former teammate. Not because I made friends with you in the process and then now we're going to go and kick it. No, I didn't have those kind of relationships. So although I think that it's great and it creates another conversation, I wasn't about that life.
All about
business. We weren't, you know?
Now, Tina, if you were the WNBA commissioner, if you were named that, that was your new role, what changes would you make?
Marketing. I would change the dollars that were spent in marketing. I know for a fact the reason why in the beginning the WNBA was so successful is because the marketing package that was put together was incredible. It force people to like pay attention to what it was that we were doing. I know that it was necessary because we were starting a league and you needed to grab people's attention. I believe that there was a period of time where the marketing wasn't very good. It was very difficult for fans and just people who wanted to watch the games to find out or know where the games were being, where the telecasts were and what networks they were on. It's great now that the WNBA has a relationship with television and that the games are on TV regularly, but they're also not marketed the way that NBA games are. If you watch an NBA game, not only are they going to talk about the games tomorrow, they're going to talk about the games like next week and the matchups to come. They're going to actually talk about the games that are being shown on a totally different network consistently. And it happens over and over and over through the telecast. And then it's on the ticker. And then on all these different talk shows, they're talking about these matchups and there's a constant conversation, you know, about it. So people are not going to forget when their favorite player is going to play. And if there is a way, and I know that it's very expensive and it's possible because the NBA is a multi-billion dollar business. If you can find a way to find the dollars to market differently, then I think that we would get more results. The WNBA is a great product. There are a lot of players that can really, really, really play. They have incredible stories. So if those stories are able to be told and, you know, the masses are get an opportunity to be more familiar with them, then I think that as a whole, how people see women's basketball will change greatly.
What are your thoughts? You know, you hear about the men and women pay and then also having some, you know, women players say, you know what, I'm not coming back to the league. I'd rather, you know, play overseas. What are your thoughts on that? How could that change?
Well, I think finances have so much to do with it. I mean, when a few of my contracts, when I went overseas, were based on the time that I spent in the WNBA and the time that I played overseas were like almost 10 times the amount that I made playing in the summer. So when you think about, I made this amount and I had to pay a certain amount of taxes, I went overseas, they're paying my taxes, and I'm playing this amount of time and I'm making this much money with bonuses and winning championships and all this kind of stuff. Like, why? So then the contracts that were less than that were like 5 or 6 times the amount. So how do you know, compete with those numbers? Like, it is, I go overseas, I have great relationships with the clubs that I play with. I come back home and I have my summer.
Right.
You know, you get to go on vacation, you get to hang out with your family, and you work out where you can do that anywhere. For some people, it's just a very difficult conversation, you know, depending on, you know, how it financially works for them. I was fortunate to have like shoe contracts and, you know, marketing contracts and different things where I had different kind of income coming in. But when we started in the first year, the offer that the WNBA gave me the first time out was, I'm not going to give the number, but it would have allowed me to qualify for public assistance in California. Like, I could have actually received food stamps.
Wow.
Right? Wow, of course, crazy. I didn't take that deal.
Right.
It was just initially kind of like where they were. And it was like, no way. Like, I'm, you know, in taking Kaplan classes to study for the LSAT. So you think that I'm going to take this money and literally deter my dreams of going to law school and for this amount of money, I'm like, no, I'll be broke for another few years and then I'll have a career. So they had to change that amount drastically. And it was about 8.5-9 times the initial offer after we were done.
Now, you mentioned law school several times during the podcast. Where did that dream come from, or where did that vision come from initially?
My uncle, so my dad's eldest brother, he was an attorney practicing. He was in Tennessee, and he had actually played football at UCLA. So he was kind of like the example, like in my family, that was like reachable. You know, he was a collegiate student athlete. And then after his career in sports, he went on to be, to get his law degree and become an attorney. My mom's parents, my grandmother and grandfather, were also both professionals, and they led a certain lifestyle. You know, they articulated in a certain way. You know, from my experience in my family, like my grandmother as well as my uncle were some of the most intelligent people that I knew. And, you know, I was a student. So it's like, yeah, like that's kind of like what I want for myself. So, and having conversations with him just about different things and, you know, his logic and his thought process. He was very just kind of precise, like even though he was a big, like funny guy, he wasted little time in just kind of articulating or getting kind of from one point like to the next. And I just thought that he was really, really, really cool. And then I liked a lot of like law shows like on TV. So that was probably a motivator. Like I was a big fan when I was a kid of Matlock. Yeah. I know, sounds crazy, but it's so true. You, Jason, you probably don't even know what Matlock is, huh? Do you?
I've heard about it. I've never watched it. I've heard about it. I've heard about it before.
That's so funny.
So, T, tell us about, you know, being inducted to the Hall of Fame. And through your basketball career, did you think that was possible?
Absolutely not. Do you know that I never even thought about it? Like, I have watched so many, you know, of those, just the shows, and just kind of like enamored, because in my thought process, I'm like, Shell Miller, Irvin Magic Johnson, or in whatever order, are my favorite players in the history of basketball. And then, you know, there's, you know, others like, you know, I love James Worthy. I had a high level of respect for Larry Bird and, you know, Michael Jordan and, you know, all these different like guys. Like my brother and I were huge Alex English fans. Like we loved Alex, you know, George Gervin like is my guy. And then, you know, when I become a professional, I get an opportunity to meet them. And then, you know, for me, it's like, these people are incredible. So I'm watching them as athletes and I think like, man, they're just incredible athletes. You have that admiration and then meeting them as people, and then they're really just good people. For me, it like just set them apart from like everybody else. And then these guys reside in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame. I am notorious, Jay, as you know, that I don't see myself like how other people see me. So I play basketball because I absolutely loved it. And I'm a very competitive person. So I want to win. So all the things that have happened in my career are simply based on that. Wanting to be the best player that I can be and winning. And just loving the game. So when these things happen, I'm not like, you know, really surprised. We're not talking about the Naismith. We're talking about the other stuff, being an all-star, whatever. It's like, man, I worked really hard. You know how many hours I spent in the gym or whatever? And like, I gave them buckets. Like, so right. Yeah.
Totally you gave them buckets, T.
Right? It's possible. So, and it's just it's a part of just the everyday functionality. The Naismith Hall of Fame is like way, way, way over there. So when I got the initial call, I was like, what? Like, are you kidding me? So I literally sat in my office. I was at the University of Texas, and I just literally sat there like, are you kidding me? Like, really? So I get off the phone and I call my brother, because my eldest brother, TJ, like, he's my guy, like, he's my ace. So, you know, I tell him about it, and he was like, for sure, home team, like, you deserve this, my dude, like, this is what we work for, you know? And I was like, dude, you're not shocked? Like, you're not surprised? He was like, man, no way. You've been cold. You've been the coldest. You've been, you know, whatever. And I'm like, T, it's the Naismith Hall of Fame. He was like, nah, man, you deserve this. This is all you. You're supposed to be here. And about time they gave my girl like what she deserved. So I got off the phone after talking to my brother. And then I'm just kind of like teary eyed. Like, I'm just getting a little emotional now. Like, I absolutely cannot believe this. So, like, as I sit in front of you guys right now today, I'm still like, I absolutely cannot believe it. It is one of those things or life moments that is going to take me a really, really long time to just be comfortable with the idea of it, because it is like the ultimate, you know, and what we do, in a culmination of like everything. And I'm just really overwhelmed at like the idea of it, because, you know, all the people that I hold really high, you know, and, you know, just my basketball experience and journey and just, you know, what I've seen them be able to do are housed there. So it's just really super cool, but at the same time, it's like, oh my goodness, like, I cannot believe this.
Man, well deserved. You know, you had a great career. Most people after that, they take a little time off, but you didn't a little bit. You got right into the college ranks of coaching. How did that come about?
Literally by chance, and the persistence of the former head coach at the University of Texas, who was Karen Aston. She literally was recruiting a kid that I kind of started mentoring by way of a friend and colleague of mine, Stephen Barber. So he was a trainer in Texas. He had spent some time in the NBA, and post his career, he got into training. So first he was training guys, and then he added a couple like high school girls to his roster. And I knew him because of JP. So we had like worked out with Steve like one day, like Jay was like, I'm working out with my guy, I want you to come and like work out. And I was like, you know, I don't do trainers, like, right. And we gonna get in the gym and we gonna work, like, that's fine, but I don't want nobody like yelling at me and talking to me crazy, you know, that's not how I work. Like, I'm gonna get in, I'm gonna work, and I'm gonna get out. He was like, come on, T, just try it. Early in the morning too, weren't we going at like 6:30 or yes. something like that?
Yeah, get in. So,
yeah, so I was like, okay, like, I'll try it. So then we get there, and Steve is a huge personality, so he start yelling at me. So I'm like, I look at JP, and I'm like, Jay, you better get your boy, or I'm going to walk out of here.
I remember that.
So then Jay was like, Steve, let me holler at you. Come here, whatever. So then, of course, because he's a guy and totally sarcastic, we're like working or whatever, and then he says something like, good job, Team T, you know, whatever. Like, I'm not going to yell at you because I know that's not what you do, kind of like thing. So I like roll my eyes at him, like, whatever. We do have a great workout, move on. So then I create a relationship with him because I have a little boy and he's starting to get into basketball. So I'm like, okay, maybe he can train with Steve. From that, Steve calls me one day and he's like, I have these young women, basketball part, I have it down pat, but you know, they come and ask me stuff and share information with me that I don't know if I want to really know, or I don't have answers for. Can you help? So I come to the gym one day, the two kids, really talented, Jordan and Brianna, like eventual McDonald's, Jordan, you know, like all Americans. So I actually just kind of started working with them and just showing them, you know, how to be efficient in the women's game and stuff like that. From that, the coach that at Texas, Jordan, committed to there. She's noticing the change in her game and how she's just so much better so quickly. So her parents, you know, she asked, well, what's going on with Jordan? Like, she looks so different, you know, like she's so much better. And her mom just says it because now I've created a relationship with his family. Oh, she works out with Tina Thompson. So the coach is like, oh, okay. You know, and she moves on, and then she calls back and she's like, wait, Tina Thompson, like, you know, the Tina Thompson? And like, yeah, but you know, at this point it's not a big deal to them because now we have kind of like kinship, you know, going on. So she then calls me one day because a position is open with her staff, and she's talking to me about Jordan, which I assume why she was calling. And she then tells me that she has a position open. So I'm thinking like, oh, okay, like I have a lot of teammates that, you know, want to get into coaching. So, you know, I'll definitely run it by them. I'm not thinking at all that she's talking about me, because all of my friends know me to know, like, I wasn't coaching anything. I was just like, these kids are too bad. My coaches that I played for stressed all the time. They aged rapidly. I was like, I don't want that to be my life. Dealing with the parents, all of that. So she's silent, like complete dead silence. And I'm like, hello, are you there? And she's like, I was actually referring to you. So I literally bust out laughing, like, you have got to be kidding me. She's silent again. And I'm like, Coach Aston, are you there? She's like, no, Tina, I'm serious. And I'm like, oh, no, ma'am. Like, I appreciate the offer, but I have no interest whatsoever. So I get her off the phone. She proceeds to call me like over and over and over again for weeks. I kid you not, I probably told her no like 20 times. She would not let up, and she just continued to ask. Jay, like, we even talked about it. Yeah. She just continued to ask. So, you know, I was just like, okay, there's a reason why she won't stop asking. Like, maybe I should listen a little bit more. And I did. Still wasn't sold. I think what kind of like wrapped me up is when I went to visit, she kind of tricked me, because when I got there, it was just supposed to be a visit. She offered me the job. But while leaving, kind of on the final part of the tour, Amani McGee Stafford was on that team. She is the little sister of JaVale McGee, also the daughter of Pam McGee, who is a USC alum. And I've known this kid since she was really little. I hadn't seen her in a very long time. She's now 6'6". And going into her senior year, she comes out and she's like, oh my gosh, Tina Thompson is gonna be our new coach. That's crazy. And I'm like, Money, no, I'm not. I'm just here. And she's like, yes, you are. Yes, you are. And I was like, no, really, I'm not. Like, I'm just here. So then she's like, because she's a huge personality. So I kind of pull her to the side and I'm like, Money, no, really, I'm not going to be your coach. You know, I'm just here visiting. She's like, I can feel that you are. I'll see you soon. And then she just kind of jets off and she's gone. So, you know, Dylan, you know, we're in my boyfriend at the time, like, they're like laughing and cracking up. So we get on the car and we go home, and I'm like, can you believe that? Like, that's so crazy. I can't believe Pam's daughter like plays here, you know? And my son Dylan is like, I think that's a sign, Mom. You know, because he's just like a smart aleck kid. He's listening to everything, you know, really bright, listening to everything, but not saying a word. And he's like, just think about it. I mean, she said, no, he didn't say she said, he said, the lady said that the contracts are only 1 year. So we can keep our house in Houston. We could get a place down there. And if it doesn't work out, we could just leave. So, you know, we could just try it out. And I was just like, Dylan, that sounds great, but I don't know. So again, the rationale at the time of this like 9-year-old changed my thought process. I'm like, I could try it. And If I don't like it, I can leave. Imani was a motivating factor because I then, you know, got home, got on my computer, looked her up. In my opinion, not having the career that she should have in college, she had had injuries and things of that nature. So it just had me thinking. Karen is still calling. Eventually, I just say yes, you know, that I'll do it. I'll try it out. I get there. Hate it. Like, hate it. It is so much more than basketball. Like, I'm going there thinking I can pour into these kids my basketball experience, change their life, and help them see the world differently, like, through sport. Just the office stuff, the time, just the everything. Like, it was so much more other stuff than actually growing the kids. So my plan was to leave. And Travis Mays, who was also the associate head coach, gets a head coaching job. The kids devastated, falling out, crying. It was like literally like a murder scene. They were so distraught. So when they collect themselves, so the, you know, head coach leaves the room, so I'm, you know, picking them up off the floor, you know, they're crying, they're whatever. I'm like, guys, it's okay, like, it's okay. Then one of them, Ariel Atkins, who's now stellar player now with the Washington Mystics, who was my kid, goes, Coach Tina, you cannot leave. You have to stay. So then I'm like, oh, God. I cannot deal with this devastation. And I'm going to break these kids if I tell them that I'm planning on leaving too. Like, Travis beat me to the punch, you know? So, yeah, I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, I'm, you know, I'm going to have to come back because I'm not going to lie. I was miserable. The best part of it was the kids. So my thought process was, I'm like, I'm just going to have to pour more into these kids. And, you know, the second year was better. The kids growing amazingly, and that's basically what kept me. And the thought process of when I get my own job, I can control the narrative, and it doesn't have to be like everybody else. It doesn't have to be the environment that everyone else created, that I can grow them in a way that just like I did as an assistant. And no, it wasn't the norm, but it worked. So, you know, that's my style. I teach kids to play the way I played, and I, you know, try to grow them with, you know, tough love, but love more than anything, and just kind of building the relationships and also just teaching them how to really play the game. So it worked out, but it was not an easy road.
It worked out, and that experience there, now I guess it gives you confidence, the relationships you build. Also, now you're the head coach at the University of Virginia. That was part of your second part of the plan, right?
Always.
Always.
Okay, you know me. Hey. Listen, I am a leader from the front. So anything that I am doing, I also want to win, and I want to be the best at it. So if being a head coach was the goal, and I decided to be an assistant, when I decided that I totally was going to be assistant and I was going to be all in, when I took the job at the University of Texas, I was also preparing to be a head coach. Absolutely.
Being a GOAT in the Hall of Fame, how do you recruit these young women?
It's tough. it's tough because to be a good collegiate basketball player or just have success, it requires so many things. It is a different set of requirements in another level when you're at a place like the University of Virginia, because education is just as important as athletic excellence. And you cannot just get a player that is really good and does not take academics as a priority. So you, one, have to look, well, at least I do, have to make sure that they can succeed here academically and it will not break them. So not whether or not they could pass, but just the stress and the rigors of that could be something that they can maintain. Because if they're not really happy in one area, it it's really hard for them to be successful, like athletically as well. So I have to recruit tough kids that are willing to work, and that those that do well academically. I mean, there's not a kid on our team that has less than maybe like a 1070 or something like that on the SAT, which is rather high. And those guys just got in, you know, like they didn't just easily get in, you know, it was a process. And I have to be willing to be patient and grow them and teach them the game. The pool of athletes that are stellar athletically are a small pool. So those kids, although I do go after them, you know, they are going to programs that are extremely established right now. You know, they have the Stanfords, the Notre Dames, and, you know, other universities on their list as a priority. We do a great job because we're getting in their top three and their top five, but there has to be a consistency in just our growth, like as a program, as a team, and them being able to have that toughness to go to a place and say, I am the difference. I don't want to be a part of what's already happening.
That's it.
And that's rare. So.
Yeah. So you're recruiting. Now, when you walk into these young women homes, like what is the reaction? What's the craziest reaction you probably got from a visit to a kid's home?
More times it's like other people, you know, family members or something like that versus the actual kids, because the kids, they, you know, they know already, like I'm not so far removed from playing. Like I retired in 2013. So a lot of the kids that I recruit know who I am, or, you know, the parents, and the kids, before you go into their home, you kind of create a relationship with them. So it's more like the extended family or something like that. They're like, man, Tim Tom, I used to watch you back in the day, that lipstick boy, you know, whatever. And I'd be like, like, not right now. You know, and then, you know, the mom or dad is just like, boy, he's crazy. We told you, you know, he loved you kind of thing or whatever. And, you know, we kind of like laugh it off and stuff like that. Or, you know, someone is like on the phone, like, let me talk to her. Like, before she leave, you got to make sure that I talk to her, which is absolutely great. And it makes for kind of like fun moments in the environment. Extremely awkward for me, but, you know, fun nonetheless.
Now, Tina, obviously you can't put yourself in this one, but if you were to pick a starting five, or you know what, you can include yourself. If you were to pick a starting five besides yourself, who would you pick on that squad?
Cynthia Cooper, Shell Swoops, Diana Taurasi, Tamika Catchings. Point guard position is tough, as well as the center position. Lauren Jackson and Lisa Leslie, they're so different. I love Lauren's game because she was like a 6'5", 6'6", version of myself. Lisa and I have won together, you know, and she just poses a different dynamic. So either one of them is a toss-up. Sheesh, point guard position the same way, you know. Goodness, I might have to just pick Lauren and Lisa and move Diana or Cynthia to the one.
Nice, nice. Respect that.
Now, also, can you explain how the Olympic runs were? Because you, when y'all are in the Olympics, it's total domination. It's not even close. Like it's basically who's playing for second and third. Because once y'all get to the Olympics, it's to the point where it seems like y'all just practicing out there. Can you explain the process of what y'all go through and the mindset of the whole team and the and what you guys do to get up for these games? Because a lot of these times it seems like it's just recreation.
It is the sacrifice. So, you know, for Olympic women's basketball, like the dedication, like what so many of the women before us like built, that they sacrifice so much to be in that environment that you have to go in there selfless. And then you're talking about the best players in America, that it is kind of like pickup for us, but the focus is laser sharp. So although it looks to everyone else that it's easy, for us is very hard, because gold medal or failure, like there is no between. In between, we are not happy with anything else other than the gold medal. So we have to smash people, because the energy that happens once they are in a game with us, it's different, because they're not expected to. So we can't afford to give anyone confidence that they don't have already have, or their skill set does not allow them to have. So we go in wanting to literally smash everybody, because we don't want anything else. We're not happy with anything else. I even recall a couple world championships where we didn't win the gold medal. I don't even have it. So the medal that we got in Brazil, someone found it in that hotel room because I left it. It's serious.
Now, how is it with the men's team as well? Because obviously y'all are both in the same venue. How is the communication between both parties? Obviously, sometimes you have to plan at the same time, but how is the communication? Is there any either rivalries there, or is there any communication between the two parties?
No. We are in total and complete support of each other. We only get to see one another's games for the most part because of just how the Olympics work. Not until we get to the medal rounds do we, or just before, do we actually have freedom, you know, to kind of like see other sports and things like that because of the distance and the venues. It's just really difficult to commute and all those things. So the games that we get to see and go to the most are one another's, and we just support each other.
I know we kept you for a long time, but man, I want to stay longer. But I know you got things.
You know, we can do a B continue, but I do have a 2 o'clock.
All right. So last thing, with the pandemic that's changed, today's life, how we live, and the social injustice that's going on, and that's a big thing right now. What are your conversations with your young women?
We talk about everything. We talk about safety and then protecting themselves and just kind of being, even responsible for, you know, others, in the sense that, because we're in close vicinity of one another, we're back at school, we're working out, like we can't afford to go out and be careless because we're working in such a tight space that if one of us go outside of the bubble, then we're taking everyone with us. And that just can't happen. So we have one shot at getting it right. So we have to follow everything to the T in order to continue. With the contact tracing, with all those things, one kid contracts the virus, 6 of our kids cannot work out. You know, it's just a really tough situation in regards to just the social unrest that's going on in society. I encourage them to be unapologetically Black, and I support them in that as long as they are not being cruel, disrespectful, or unattentive to other people and their feelings. But they do not need to apologize at all for who they are, and that it is important that every day they show up, they bring the best version of themselves. So there is no conversation about what it is that they bring.
Last thing, I always like to end with this segment called Free Game. Can you give people out here free game?
Absolutely. Don't be fooled by the shiny stuff and like what it looks like. Every single thing that I've gotten and I have achieved in this very blessed journey that I have, rest on the foundation of work. I've worked for every single bit of it, and nothing was given to me. There is no magic pill. There is no magic potion. Get your game up, get your weight up, get in the gym. There is no substitute for that.
Thanks. That's free game coming from Tina Thompson. Appreciate your time. Thanks. Much love always.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Yo, this is James Posey. Thanks for checking out Posecast, brought to you by basketballnews.com. You can check out Posecast every Thursday on all your listening platforms.
Presenting sponsor of the Posecast is greensupply.com. With everything going on in the world, it is more important than ever to stay safe. At greensupply.com, you can purchase masks, hand sanitizer, and other important health and wellness products, all in stock with same-day shipping. Best of all, listeners can get 10% off their order when using the promo code POSEY at checkout. That's P-O-S-E-Y for 10% off your order of KN95 or cloth mask, hand sanitizer, or other supplies like forehead thermometers and UV boxes. Visit greensupply.com. That's greensupply.com today.